Well, first, let me thank you all for having us here at your beautiful campus. We are going to convene our arguments here today just as we would if we were in the courtroom. We are going to take a little liberty. I'm going to introduce to you all of our attorneys here, and they're going to take a moment and tell you a little bit about their case. Ordinarily, in our courtroom, in either Carson City or Las Vegas, there is no preamble, if you will. There is no discussion. The attorneys stand, they announce themselves, and we begin argument. We have very strict time constraints. Our attorneys have a little mechanism on their podium. We have the same thing here. It actually tells them how much time they have. They have 15 minutes. You will hear, I presume. The petitioner in this case has the opportunity to reserve time for rebuttal, and if they choose to do so, that comes off of their 15 minutes. Both sides get the exact same time to present their arguments to us. And with that, I'm going to begin by introducing the first case, which is the case of Charleston Station versus Stevens. We have as lead counsel for the appellants, Mr. Eisenberg, and we have as lead counsel for the respondents, Mr. Levine. I'm going to ask both Mr. Eisenberg if you would stand and explain make a basic statement about what the case means to you, what it is about. I'm going to then ask Mr. Levine both to explain it from the respondent's standpoint as well as to introduce his co-counsel who are seated with him at his table. Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for allowing us to present this case to you today. My name is Rob. I live here in Reno. I think you'll find this to be a very interesting case that arises
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Levine, or Mr. Marks.
My name is Jeremy Marks, and we tried the case in Las Vegas with Ron Bucknell, and I believe that we fought a marketing scandal for the time that we were in Las Vegas. And the case, my client is Larry Stevens, his wife is in Houston. Larry Stevens, in December 2007, had a cardiac arrest to discuss a type of heart attack where he was and his heart stopped. His heart did not want to get oxygen to his brain. And you will hear that he's in Reno about 6 minutes, where he has CPR, oxygen, and use of the AED, which he considers a very common skill for his body. He is not used. The first indication will suffer a gradual brain damage, and that's what happens to the procedure. And we are in the court below.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. And I have the pleasure of working with two of the other members of this panel. We represent three of the seven justices on the Supreme Court. To my left is Justice Christina Pickering, and to my right is Justice Mark Gibbons. And we'll be giving you some time to answer questions when the arguments are over as well. So with that, are the parties ready to proceed? Very well.
Attempt to reserve 5 minutes.
Very well.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Eisenberg on behalf of the appellant. I understand that Bishop Minogue is a private entity. Suppose the principal at this school went out, purchased an AED, had selected teachers trained in CPR and how to use the AED, and then adopted a policy for emergency procedures. And then suppose a visitor to the school had a heart attack, and one of the trained teachers came over and decided not to do CPR or use the AED. Would we hold the school liable because the school had an AED and because the school had trained its teachers? And if we held them liable because of those things, wouldn't we be discouraging schools and businesses from doing those extra things and from going the extra mile? The public policy in this state should be to encourage businesses to do those things and not to punish them for doing good things. There are two really crucial, important facts in this case that I want to bring out right at the beginning. First of all, it was absolutely undisputed that the diligent and quick response by the employees at the Red Rocks saved Mr. Stevens' life. Every doctor who testified on liability conceded that. And the second fact that I want to mention is that the first professional medical responders on the scene, who arrived only 6 minutes after Mr. Stevens had his heart attack, was paramedic Hardcastle and his assistant EMT. They got there, they assessed Mr. Stevens, they evaluated his respiration and his pulse, and they determined that he did not need immediate CPR or defibrillation. Yet the Red Rock has been held liable because its 26-year-old security guard, who's considered a layperson, even though he had some training, the 26-year-old security guard decided not to do CPR or use the AED, the same decision that the trained professional paramedic made. Yet the Red Rock was held liable for that. On the question of the legal duty, we think the case of Lee versus GNLV is crystal clear. It shouldn't be overruled. It shouldn't be limited. In that case, a customer at a restaurant had a choking incident. The restaurant did not do the Heimlich maneuver on it. And this court recognized that in a medical emergency, in most cases, people do not have a duty to render aid. If I see somebody who has a heart attack while I'm walking down the street, I can just ignore them. But where there's a special relationship, this court held in Lee, such as the relationship between a customer and a hotel or a restaurant, or even between a teacher and a student, if there's a special relationship, then there is a duty. But the duty is limited, the court held in Lee. And it's the same type of limitation that the court recognized in the Turner case, the baseball accident case, where the court said that the court decides what the limitations are on a duty. And Justice Gibbons, even though you dissented and concurred in Turner, you agreed with the concept that the court has the right to limit a duty in certain situations, although you felt that the limited duty didn't apply in that.
Now, Mr. Eisenberg, just again for the benefit of the students, as I recall in that baseball case, a lady was sitting in the beer garden in the baseball stadium in Las Vegas, the AAA Las Vegas 51s, and she was drinking a beer, not watching a game, and somebody hit a baseball and hit her, hit the patron there, but there was no screen or anything there to block, to deflect the baseball, and she wasn't in the stand, she was in a restaurant area, so I believe the split in the court was that should the stadium had should there have been more protections there for your patrons when they're in the restaurant area versus is if you're in a stadium anywhere and you get hit by a baseball, you assume the risk of injury by going to the baseball stadium. So is that correct as far as?
That's correct. And even though you believe that the limited duty rule didn't apply in the area where she was located, where she got hit by the baseball, you agreed with the concept that the court can limit duty in certain situations. And that's exactly what the court did in Lee versus GNLV. Mm-hmm. The court cited cases from other states, and the court said that if the business calls for professional medical help, stays with the customer, and perhaps performs basic first aid, such as stopping bleeding, maybe, then the entity has satisfied its legal duty. And the court said in that case that the restaurant employees had no duty to do the Heimlich maneuver. And the court cited the Drew case from Wyoming, where the court held that summoning medical assistance within a reasonable time satisfies the requirement that the restaurateur exercise reasonable care. And then the Lee court went on to conclude that the restaurant's employees examined and assessed the victim's condition immediately. They diligently monitored the victim's condition, and they summoned professional medical assistance. And the court said, quote, thus we cannot say that the behavior of GNLV's employees in this circumstance was anything other than reasonable. We perceive no breach of the duty owed to Strums in failing to perform the Heimlich maneuver. We are able to conclude as a matter of law that GNLV's employees did not breach this duty.
Okay, Mr. Eisenberg, let me ask you this. I understand your argument, but generally these cases are submitted to judges or juries, and when a jury decides the case, we have to defer to the jury's decision as to factual findings. In this particular case, on the negligence issue, the jury concluded that the hotel was negligent by not rendering the proper assistance here to Mr. Stevens, and whether we agree or disagree with what the jury did, don't we have to defer to the jury and their findings of fact in this particular case? And if you don't think so, maybe you could talk about NRS 41.500 and the standard that you feel should be applicable in this particular case.
Well, no, I don't believe you need to defer to the jury, because in this case we're arguing that as a matter of law, there was no duty, or there was a limited duty, and they complied with it, just like in the GNLV case. In the GNLV, Lee versus GNLV, the district judge granted summary judgment. This court affirmed. In our case, the district court denied summary judgment, but we're contending that that was error as a matter of law. This case should have never gotten to the jury. And the statute that you mentioned, the Good Samaritan statute, is really more of a defense. And my point on the GNLV, Lee versus GNLV case, is that there was no duty in the first place, or not no duty, but there was a limited duty. And if there's no duty for a restaurant to give the Heimlich maneuver, which is a pretty easy maneuver to do, you don't have to have any training. If you've seen it on TV or something, you can do it. If there's no duty for a restaurant's employees to do the Heimlich maneuver, how can there be a duty, a legal duty under the law, for a casino security guard to do CPR or to use an AED? So we believe as a matter of law, move for summary judgment, move for directed verdict or judgment as a matter of law. Jury instructions, we ask for judgment in our favor at every stage. And our contention is the judge erred by.
And clearly, Mr. Eisenberg, you argue that instruction number 26 was improper, but do I read the briefs correctly wherein it appears as if you acknowledge that your client's employee did, in fact, depart from company policy? You don't really argue that, do you?
No, I'm not arguing that today.
Okay.
I have a question more theoretical, and that is the restatement second versus restatement third, and restatement third, section 40 particularly. It seems to me arguable that Lee is almost an a fortiori holding here, because the restatement third talks about section 40 applies with regard to risks that arise within the scope of the relationship. And to me, in Lee, the person was in the restaurant eating the food that the restaurant provided. So the risk of choking on that food is tied to that relationship. Whereas in this case, it strikes me, and you make the argument in your reply, that perhaps Section 40 doesn't even apply because this heart attack was entirely unrelated to where he was at the moment that it occurred. In other words, he wasn't in an exercise club where, you know, we increased his heart rate and made him run on a treadmill and then he had a heart attack. He wasn't in an airplane where they couldn't land and get him to medical assistance. There was nothing in the relationship that produced the event, the response to which is allegedly negligent. Have you found cases that are reading Section 40 of Restatement Third to support that argument? Do you follow the question?
Because the restatement third, Section 40, is
so new.
Pretty new. My understanding was only published in 2012. I haven't found any cases one way or another. My argument was based on the plain language of the restatement.
That the risk doesn't arise from the relationship uniquely.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the plain language of and common sense tells you that if that there should be some kind of relationship before there's even more of a duty. There are other reasons, several other reasons, why the restatement third should not apply that are in our brief. But to get back, Justice Sadie, to your question about the policy of the casino, that's what was my whole point at the beginning here, is that the Red Rock was held liable because it adopted a policy that it didn't have to adopt in the first place. And the standard of negligence is the standard of negligence. And defendants are held liable for violating that standard. But if they have an internal policy that where they require their employees to comply with a higher standard, you can't punish them for adopting that higher standard and hold them liable for violating that higher standard. Otherwise, businesses will just say, why bother?
So are you arguing that the law sets a standard at level A, shall we say, and when a company such as the Red Rock chooses to establish a company policy that is at a higher level, level B, shall we say, that the law only recognizes or need recognize level A?
That's correct, not only based on the law, but based on public policy, that you shouldn't punish a business, or you should actually encourage them to adopt stricter standards for their employees. But if their employees violate it, it's still not negligence, because negligence is a regular standard based on duties established by this
court. But the higher standards that they adopt are evidence of the reasonableness of adhering to that practice, right? I mean, they don't establish the legal basis, but they do establish reasonableness.
Well, it can be some evidence of reasonableness, but in this case, you have a situation where the judge instructed the jury that they can consider whether somebody has extra training in determining negligence, and then the plaintiff's counsel, that's pretty much all they relied on.
But in closing argument, your point is that they argued Instruction 26 and said, in essence, they had these standards, they had to follow them, they breached these internal standards, and therefore they're liable. And your point is that's not the law.
That's not true. In fact, even in this court, in their answering brief, what they say is, the Stevenses are only asking that the Red Rock be held responsible when its employees acted negligently by failing to comply with their own training, policies, and procedures. But that's not the standard. But that's what Judge Weese allowed the jury to do, is to consider that higher standard, that internal standard, and then use it to punish the Red Rock for adopting that standard. I see I have less than 2 minutes to go here.
So. Mr. Eisenberg, I'm going to give you 4 minutes in rebuttal, which means I'm going to add 2 minutes to the other side as well, so you'll have at least a four-minute rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Marks.
Justice Saeda, members of the court, Red Rock has just urged you to reverse 400 years of Anglo-American common law, some 50 years of the restatement second and third, and over 20 years of precedent in this state, that negligence cases, as Justice Gibbons pointed out, are decided on a case-by-case basis by a jury under a reasonable person standard. We are not, if I can have you on the board, we're not asking for any expansion of the law. Contrary to everything in their brief, we're not asking every business to buy an AED. We're not asking every business to train their employees in CPR. We're asking that you follow what you said in Lee. In Lee, under the second restatement, the one that they quote from your first aid, you specifically said there is a duty, an affirmative duty to aid a patron in peril. Because as you know, at common law, it was a very high, utmost care for an innkeeper. That's been in modern times reduced to a reasonable care. But it's way beyond the example of what you have on passing someone on the street. It's beyond a lot of other legal obligations. Under Lee, it's a question of fact for the jury. That was reiterated by this court in Lee, that negligence cases are decided on a case-by-case basis. They are asking for a rule that would say all you have to do in any instance, no matter what the situation, is call 911. That's what they're telling you without saying it. In Lee, you were impressed by the fact that the employees of GNLV brought oxygen and actually did CPR. The cases they have cited in their brief, Lamonis, the Florida case, the coach actually did CPR. And that case, which is cited extensively, we in our supplemental authorities posted the link of the argument before the Florida Supreme Court, which I encourage you to listen to, because although oral argument is not always dispositive, a number of judges indicated on the record they could not see Lamonis standing, that it would be reversed on, and for the same reason that I'm telling you this should be affirmed, that it's a reasonable care standard on a case-by-case basis. The school district in Lamonis wanted a per se rule that AED should never be used, no matter what the training, no matter what the situation. What's important here is it's beyond just the training. They are trying to say that any procedure, no matter what it is, should not be used. And that's kind of silly in modern times, because 50 years ago, someone might be stumbling for quarters for a payphone. Most of the students in this room may not even remember a time before iPhones. Now you have a computer literally in everyone's pocket. Apple introduced an iWatch that basically takes heartbeats. We're saying you have to look at the totality of all the circumstances in every case. In car accident cases, we don't ignore the developments of computers in a car or seatbelts or airbags. We don't say cars of 50 years ago is the legal standard for today. In Lamonis, their best case, the judge actually wrote, what we're writing today may not be the law tomorrow. Basically, beware, attorneys and judges, that the rule we're actually writing may not stand. The judge said it for himself because of changes in technology and medicine. Nevada has always been a restatement jurisdiction. Justice Pickering, you rejected the same argument that counsel just made in the Fiesta Palms case. It is not limited duty. It's duty of an innkeeper. And the issue is, what are the actions within that duty? Are you going to draw a line and say today, whatever technology may be there, does not have to be used? Or are you going to allow the cases to go on a case-by-case basis? What's interesting here, if you could put
do you, before you move on from that, and it's the same question pretty much I asked Mr. Eisenberg, talking about Restatement Third, which Foster versus Costco endorsed in that setting anyway, whether we've moved to Restatement Third or not is another question. But assume for purposes of this that Restatement Third, we're looking at it, we're talking about it, and you want it to apply. What do you do with the language that seems to tie the risk in Section 40 to something that arises from the relationship? To my mind, that's a problem for your side of this case, and it's different from Fiesta Palms, because in Fiesta Palms, they were throwing the things into the crowd, so their activity enhanced or created the risk. Similarly, some of the cases on defibrillation, like if you're in a plane and you have a heart episode, it's foreseeable that somebody there needs that access to that equipment to survive that episode. It's a little different here. I'm struggling to put the risk.
I want to answer that two ways, and one is the board will answer it, but
okay.
Let me directly answer.
I'm sorry to get ahead.
First
of
all, the comments of Section 40, I think it's Comment D, I'm not sure, I don't have that specific site. They specifically reject the limitation of the danger. And I think, as you pointed out in Fiesta Palms, you only get limited duty if it's a if it's something relating to baseballs hitting you at a ball game or the bumper car issue. You have regular duty. We think we can prevail under Lee, which is a second restatement case, even if you don't want to go to the
third. But restatement third even recognizes Lee as an instance where there's a limitation that's judicially built.
Of Heimlich. And yeah. Contrary to what counsel, my friend, opposing counsel said, the evidence at Lee was that the employees were not trained at Heimlich, and that Heimlich was moving more into the medical realm that you had to be trained. The point here is, it wasn't just that Red Rock adopted policies. They make it sound like these are policies in a school that, you know, were very flexible, you could do or not use the policies. These are very well-trained security personnel. They had a two-day course in AED and CPR. 2 days, that two full days of training is, for instance, more than the CLE requirement for attorneys. It's more than when I was a Supreme Court settlement judge. I think it's more training. It's more training than the lawyers receive to do their job. They were recertified every 6 months. They carried masks. In other words, in these other cases, there may not be evidence that these security guards had plastic masks, so you weren't doing CPR like mouth-to-mouth that you see on TV. It's modern CPR that was adopted after the 2005 American Heart Association guidelines. The AEDs were checked every 8 hours. There were 5 AEDs in this hotel, casino, spa. We're not saying that this rule applies to every entity in every corner of Nevada. We're saying you can affirm based on the unique facts of this case.
So, but what do you do with his argument that if we rule in your favor, we're penalizing the good companies that try to adopt modern technology and have it at hand by saying if you do that and you fail to use it or use it appropriately, you're going to be held liable, whereas the sawdust joint down the street that has nothing and does nothing except says, you know, you can have a beer here and play some slot machines, but you're on your own as far as any episodes. We're kind of incentivizing the wrong thing.
No, I understand, and I want to try to answer that. First, and I need to answer it two different ways. First of all, right now, absent the legislature saying there's AEDs in certain public buildings, an individual business does not have to purchase an AED. Nothing that you would write in this opinion affirming it would change that. Nothing would say you have to send people for CPR training. The cat is already out of the bag because about 15, 18 years ago, Clark County Fire went to casinos because casinos were a place where people, because of the stress, had heart attacks. That's the New England Journal of Medicine, Valenzuela, Dr. Valenzuela's seminal article. And people were having heart attacks, and it's a societal cost to die or have brain damage. And through AEDs, which we showed the jury how dummy-proof they are, they're easier than operating a computer. This is not advanced medicine. We showed them that anyone that had the 1 or 2 day training could utilize it because the machine talks to and walks you through it. There's no incentive or disincentive. If they would have used the equipment, their argument would be they would have immunity under NRS 41500, the Good Samaritan statute. The problem is they did nothing. Your choice
is... So you agree that 41500 would have applied had they used it, but used it incorrectly?
It arguably could have applied. They got the judge gave them the CPR Good Samaritan instruction.
And I'm not sure it applies, but...
But the judge gave it to them. In other words, they're criticizing the judge's jury instructions. They got a Good Samaritan instruction. They got an emergency instruction which allowed them to argue to the jury, don't judge us, don't Monday morning quarterback, so to speak, don't judge us under the calm courtroom, look at what we did in the heat of battle, look at what we did. They got that instruction. So with those two instructions, they could argue certainly that they acted reasonably. You have to watch the video. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to watch the video. Literally, I could stop now for the rest of my argument. People walked by Mr. Stevens. They didn't control the scene. They literally did nothing. We are allowed to get the instruction on use of your training and experience. Nothing in that instruction mandates the experience. It said those are factors you can take into account. That is right out of Prosser and Keaton. That's restatement law. And if you have training experience, a jury can take that into account. Another point I think is being missed is a common law duty of an innkeeper not to aggravate an injury. And really, really poignant testimony was the security guard called dispatch at Red Rock. They had a dedicated line to 911. In that conversation, they said, patron not breathing, AED called for. Not only did they have the affirmative duty that you've set forth in Lee, they on their own knew they had to use the AED in that situation. When we tried the case, there was no explanation as to why the AED wasn't, once it didn't come in 90 seconds, their policy was to bring it in 90 seconds, that why it wasn't called for again. Our best witness was their director of security. Their director of security said, in this situation, as had happened in previous heart attacks just months before, that those other incidents were discussed in front of the jury, that the AED should have been used and CPR should have been given. That was their policy. They argued in front of the jury, they acted reasonably. While today they're obviously, they didn't waive the argument of preserving the duty, they tried the case on the same basis that I'm arguing. They tried the case on the American Heart Association workbook and standards. And they spent a ton of time arguing whether he was breathing or not, whether he was unconscious or not, and that was a question of fact for the jury.
Mr. Marks, let me ask you this. Getting to that argument, did they argue affirmatively that NRS 41.500 applies and the standard is gross negligence versus general negligence? Or tell me about that, because I'm somewhat confused with the record if they raised that and if their argument was that if there's negligence, you have to prove gross negligence, I mean, your side versus just general negligence.
Okay, well, I'll answer that. First of all, they didn't raise NRS 41.500 as an affirmative defense. They argue in their brief that although we objected to them raising it based on the facts of the case, based on the plain meaning of the statute, we didn't specifically say you didn't raise it in the pretrial and the pleadings. Now they're trying to argue that although they would have waived it, we counter-waived it, and they should be able to argue it. On the issue of the CPR, they got that instruction and they argued that to the jury, because they're claiming they did CPR even though they didn't do child.
So they weren't grossly negligent. That was their argument to the jury.
Okay. On that point. But I think what's really important, if you look at the exhibit, which is the American Heart Association standards, most of the trial was a battle over those standards. They adopted those standards and worked with the Clark County and City Fire Department to implement those standards. It's not a question of a rule you make today, everyone is not going to buy AEDs. The AEDs are in the casino. The rule you make today is use them. If you use them and you make a mistake, you're arguably protected under the Good Samaritan. But don't sit there for 6.5 minutes with your walkie-talkie and do nothing when you have the AEDs. And if one person doesn't bring it, call the other person.
So, Mr. Marks, you would perhaps take the level B approach that I described when I asked Mr. Eisenberg a question, and you would argue that the law sets out level A standard of care, duty of care, but that once these training, the training sessions and the various devices that are the new technology, et cetera, in the casino are there and their company employees are trained on them, then they go to a level B standard of care, and that's what this court needs to look at.
You can affirm on level A that it's reasonable care under Lee. Your own words, an affirmative duty to aid a patron in peril.
Period.
That affirmative duty encompasses all the resources at their disposal. They chest compression, CPR, even in the cases they cite for no AED, the employees in three of the cases, including Mississippi, the Nevada case Lee, and Florida, did CPR. We can prevail on their failure to do CPR, which would have perfused oxygen to the brain. They had a program for AEDs. I'm assuming those AEDs could be used for employees. They could be used for the CEO if he had a heart attack. That's not new. They've had it for probably 18 years. We called the fire Captain Bellinger, who came in, explained the program. We showed the film of the AED. This isn't new. It's not the Apple Watch that came out yesterday. It's at least 15 years old. The law, the common law, and the restatement and Prosser says you can take into account the training experience of those people. If you're walking around with a CPR mask every day, it's certainly foreseeable that you would have to use it. They're asking for a rule that no matter what training you have, no matter what equipment you have, all you have to do is 911. That's a 50-year-old standard. It's not a modern standard in the iPhone 8.
So the reasonable person standard in this case, who carries the protected mouth gear, must in fact use that.
The jury has to decide should, not must. Is it reasonable for them to use it or not use it? If they didn't use it in the facts of this case, where their own security people called for the AED, they were trained in CPR and had the mask, they called dispatch and said they were calling for the AED, a jury could conclude they were negligent. You can affirm on that basis. Another jury with other facts, with other situations, on a case-by-case basis, could have a different result.
Which takes us back to Justice Gibbons' question of, isn't this a case where we look to the jury's decision with deference and we move forward from that basis?
Because their argument on breathing, et cetera, most of their opening brief is a factual dispute they can't win. The jury ruled in our favor on the facts. And negligence in Nevada is usually a question of fact.
Further questions?
Just in conclusion, we think we can prevail under the second restatement if you don't want to go to the third. We think the third clarifies the second. We think the third says AEDs, modern technology, should be taken into account. And we think under Lemonis, if you look at what Florida is talking about, they're also the justices of the Supreme Court, not the Court of Appeals, are saying if AEDs are there, use them. You can't just put them on the shelf or put them on a golf cart and not use them. In this modern world, you use the technology that's available, and then you determine reasonableness on a case-by-case basis. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Mr. Eisenberg, in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's our position it's not a question of fact. It's a question of law, just like it was a question of law in Lee, Turn, every other case. The establishment of a limited duty precludes a defendant from being held liable. And all we're asking you to do is look at that overwhelming case law from around the country that has not just applied the rule from Lee versus GNOV, but has actually applied Lee versus GNOV itself. As recently as just a few months ago in the O'Gwin case, which involved a heart attack at a casino, and the court said there was no legal duty to provide CPR or use an available AED, and the court cited and relied on this court's decision in Lee versus GNOV. It truly is overwhelming. In case after case, whether it's in a health club, or a casino, a restaurant, a hotel, an ice skating rink, everywhere, courts have said there is no legal duty for the proprietor to perform CPR or to use an AED, even if it's available. Justice Sated, you again touched on the concept of the A duty and the B duty. We cited the case of Duran, which is an Illinois case from just a couple years ago, where a student at a school had a heart attack. And the theory was that the school should have used an available AED. And the court said, as a matter of public policy, we do not believe it would be appropriate to impose a legal duty on a party to provide emergency medical care simply because that party voluntarily purchased an AED. Such a holding would discourage institutions from purchasing such medical devices.
Mr. Eisenberg, can I ask you this? And I understand your argument is that as a matter of law, we need to reverse the case based on the authority you've cited. Are you also arguing that the correct legal standard is gross negligence versus general negligence? Or is it just strictly a legal issue? What's your position on that?
No, we're arguing that in addition to the fact that there was a limited duty as a matter of law under Lee and the other cases, we're also arguing that as a matter of law, the Red Rock had the available Good Samaritan defense under the statute, because there was no evidence of gross negligence. Gross negligence is when you do nothing. Mr. Mark stands here and says the Red Rock did nothing, but the witnesses said the Red Rock did several different things, and all of those things together saved Mr. Stevens' life.
But Good Samaritan said it was not pled as an affirmative defense. Was it in your answer?
It wasn't, but it was raised numerous times. Motion for summary judgment, at trial, motion for directed verdict, or JMOL. It was raised during jury instructions. It was raised after. The plaintiffs never once contended that it should have been raised as an affirmative defense and that we somehow...
Did your client move to amend its answer to assert 41.500 as an affirmative defense?
No, and the reason is because the plaintiffs never contended that it needed to be raised as an affirmative defense. If they had raised that issue, the very first time they ever raised that is in their answering brief in this court. If they had raised it, in a moment, they would have been granted leave to amend the answer.
So your point is it was litigated by consent under Rule 15?
Absolutely, absolutely, under Rule 15.
What do you do with their point that this really was a jury question? I understand the Lee case. The Lee case is difficult unless you say it was a public policy determination that we're going to cabin the limits of that duty. But Lee tries to back away from that and say it just wasn't reasonable. I mean, Lee recognizes duty as a question of law and that breach of duty is a question of fact ordinarily. But then it says summary judgment in this case was appropriate because the conduct was reasonable, which is really in the arena of fact. So Lee's a bit of a peculiar case.
Well, Lee did two things. First of all, the court established the duty, defined the duty, and then applied it in that case. And in defining the duty, the court said there's a limited duty, and there was no duty in that case.
But it stopped short of saying in every instance it's enough to just call 911. It kind of leaves some wiggle room at the outer limits.
I respectfully disagree with you. If you read the language of it, it seems to indicate, and its reliance on the Drew case, which said...
So you say it's Lee establishes as a matter of law, all you have to do is call 911 and you're done.
For the most part, you could read it that way. Okay. And what other courts have read that rule and applied that rule and basically said the same thing.
Okay.
But if you go beyond that and you look at CPR and AEDs, court after court after court has said there's no duty to do those procedures, even if they have available AED, and even if they have training in CPR.
And they're doing that as a matter of duty, as a legal determination of duty rather than reasonableness?
Absolutely. As a matter of law, courts are granting summary judgment in those cases.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Thank you, Mr. Marks. The case will stand submitted.